Welcome to Dads on the Air for the 20th of May 2008. Should be a really interesting show. We have Professor Mark Wooden, who's created an absolute stir by suggesting that if women want to be paid the same as men, they should work as long an hours as men often do.
Shock horror. How dare he say that?
And that, of course, has created an absolute furor right round the country. And we also have an interesting debate on domestic violence from an expert in the US.
Professor Richard B. Felsen, he's an academic, been working in the area of violence and as a sociologist and a professor of criminology at Pennsylvania University. He's been working for many, many decades on this. Basically, he challenges the gender perspective on violence and takes a violence perspective instead, what he calls a violence perspective. Very interesting stuff, and challenging the feminist norms around DV that have been around for decades. So that should be very interesting.
And we'll also be looking at the whole story about removing the word fathers from birth certificates to appease lesbian couples, and that will be a really interesting story too. Don't forget, you can listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net. Please don't confuse us with dadsontheair.com, which continues to operate despite our best efforts to have it closed down. But unfortunately, it's still confusing people. It's dadsontheair.net, and you can listen to this program from there. And also, I'd like to welcome people who are joining us from around the world via the live streaming at the 2GLF website. The technology is wonderful these days. We can be listened to in Siberia now. Okay, Professor Wooden really caused a stir when he said that women needed to act more like men if they wanted to earn the same money. The call has come from social researcher Professor Mark Wooden and has been backed by the Australia's peak industry body, the Australian Industry Group. He said the pay equity gap between men and women in Australia will not close until women are prepared to work longer hours. And he said men are earning on average 15% more than women because they put in more time at the workplace. He said all high achievers in all walks of life put in long hours into their activity. It's the pay equity gap got a lot to do with the fact that men are not prepared to work longer hours. Women are not prepared to work longer hours. And of course, if you look around the office at 5 o'clock, it's the blokes that are still sitting at the desks. The women, and one of the arguments, which is quite well-founded in a way, is that the whole attitude to work has to change if we want to get this work-family life balance set up. Professor Wooden said even if workplaces were family friendly, many women would not pursue long hour jobs. Said the Professor Wooden was the only male taking part in a National Press Club panel discussion, and his remarks drew gasps from the mostly female audience. The panel, including Federal Minister for the Status of Women Tanya Plibersek, who's not been invited onto our program but yet to respond, was looking at why the pay equity gap has been around 15% over the past decade. On average, for every dollar earned by a full-time male employee, a female will earn 85 cents. A recent report by the Equal Opportunity for Women in the Workplace Agency found that female chief executives earned about two-thirds of the median wage of male counterparts, and also found that female graduates entering the workforce earn about $3,000 less than their male counterparts. This has caused an absolute stir on a number of levels. And now Heather Ridout, she's the head, and a highly respected, I might say, woman. She is the head of the Australian Industry Group, and she told the National Press Club last week that women needed to be more aggressive to get a promotion because many men had been elevated above their abilities. Professor Wooden from the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economics and Social Research was also on the Press Club panel, and he said it was a big call for women to ever reach pay equity because of this inclination not to work long hours. But Ridout has said she supports him, which is interesting. A real blockbuster of a column. He's had some support from some interesting areas, Andrew Bolt, and we'll come back to that later in the program, but he basically said that Well, you cannot have everything. Women cannot have everything. They cannot have these great jobs and also look after the family, and you really have to make a decision one way or the other. Another story that's really causing a stir.
This one's a shocker. Appearing in over the weekend in the Sun Herald, under the heading Father to Go from Birth Certificates, Heath Gilmore writes, a controversial new bill that will remove the word father from birth certificates to recognise lesbian couples who have children through IVF will be put before New South Wales Parliament. 50 laws across New South Wales covering the Local Government Act, Industrial Relations Act and the Constitution will be amended to include new parental presumption protection for female same-sex couples. The bill equates the position of a lesbian partner of a woman who has a child after becoming pregnant by a fertilisation procedure other than sexual intercourse to the position of a married woman's husband.
So 50 different pieces of legislation are going to change.
Yeah, so that lesbians can basically say that they're fathers. I mean, this makes my skin crawl. This is the most disgusting thing I've had to read out on this program ever, I think. This is an absolute attack from the lesbian left on fatherhood. It doesn't come more blatant than this. Take the father off the birth certificate. I'm sorry. This is disgraceful. I'm amazed that the New South Wales government, even though it is staffed by a bunch of failures and dropkicks, the Labor government, the Yemma Labor government, I'm amazed that even that bunch of losers would consider something as divisive and as fundamentally ridiculous as this, to bring something like this into law, to take the name father off a child's birth certificate so that, and that what, the 1% of lesbian couples can feel happy. I mean, this is ridiculous.
It's probably 0.01%.
And what percentage of couples, you know, normally have a father? I mean, is this 99.9% of people who will be inconvenienced for a new designation to fit in for the lesbians? I mean, whoopee. I think this is madness. This is absolute madness. This is the stupidest thing I've ever had to read out on this program. That's all I'll say.
Well, we're going to be talking with Warwick Marsh a little later in the show about this issue, so I think we'll...
Yeah, Warwick will give it a good rev. I mean, this is
it brings
stupid.
Up a lot of issues.
How dare they undermine fatherhood to that degree? Well, I mean, I don't agree with same-sex couples having children. Personally, I think it's an abomination. You know, I think that's one of the downsides of homosexuality. If you're going to be gay, well, you have to accept the fact that you can't have children with your chosen partner. I mean, that's just biology, people. You know, wake up and smell the coffee. I mean, you don't take the word father off the birth certificate to basically pander to a bunch of anomalies. This is ridiculous.
I think we'd probably all agree to have different positions here. I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that both gay men and gay women, I'm not opposed to them raising children. However, all the social science evidence shows that children need to be raised by a mother and a father, and if that's not available, they need a strong male and female role model. So if gay men or lesbians are going to raise kids, they have to organise for a substitute or surrogate mum or dad, the missing gender, in order for that child to be raised in a healthy manner. And so, you know, it's a little bit cheeky, but I think they should consider going the other way. And instead of removing the word father from the birth certificate, lesbian mothers should be told that they must put down the name of the man who is going to act as that child's father.
Yeah, nominate a father figure for this child.
For that child.
Absolutely.
And of course, the other way around. If two men are raising a child as a gay couple, they should nominate a mother for that child as well.
A mother figure, yes.
Mother figure or a stepmum or a godmother, whatever you want to call it. But that is the way that we're going to raise healthy children.
It is interesting that they don't even mention male gay couples, a lot of whom would like to adopt children, and certainly in England and places like that, a lot of gay male couples are adopting children.
And not only that, they're arranging with surrogate mothers to give birth to a child for them, and actually using their genetic material. So, and this, you know, it's not as common for biological reasons as lesbian couples, but it does happen. Where are they in this legislation?
I know. We've had gay dads on this program, and we're certainly not anti-gay on this program, but this is really taking it all way too far. We'll be back in a moment. Talking with Professor Mark Wooden. He's from the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economics and Social Research, and he's become something of a reluctant celebrity this week. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks for inviting me.
Mark, we'll just fill in the listeners. The week before last, I believe, or it may have been last week, you were at the National Press Club talking about the pay equity gap between men and women, so the difference in average earnings between men and women in Australia. And you made some... the press seems to have reported it as if it's controversial comments. To us, it seems like common sense that women may actually, on average, earn less than men because they don't work as long hours as men, and there may be some other factors in there. Would you like to explain your argument, basically?
Yeah, as you said, I didn't think it was particularly controversial, but apparently it was. It's a very simple concept, very standard in economics, labour economics, in the field in which I work, is that earnings are a function of a number of things, and one of those is sort of experience and effort. Okay, so, you know, when we work out this pay gap, it's pretty clear that on average men earn a lot more than women. Now, one of the reasons for that is that there are a lot of women working part time, much more than men. And I think it's something like 45% of the employed women are working part time versus 15% of the men. So that's okay. So the first thing you do is divide by number of hours work in a week, but you then still see this gap of 13%. So the view is, well, if we've divided by hours, how can that be? But what they forget is it's not just the reward for effort is also a function of your lifetime hours. So if up to that previous point, women's careers have involved less time at the job, then by and large, they're on average, they're going to have accumulated less experience. And so therefore, they're not going to have been promoted as rapidly as the men. And so therefore, in a lifetime perspective, you will see this gap open up. Okay, it doesn't apply, of course, that we're dealing with averages here. There are plenty of women who work long hours and over their career, and by and large, you would expect, hope, that they would be promoted just as rapidly as the men. But
and likewise, there are some stay-at-home dads who, you know, work...
and by and large, yeah, they're going to be penalised in the workforce. That's one of the things, is that if there is a discrimination here, I think the controversy, and this is, I'm only reading this between the lines, the controversy is that the implication of my comments were that you can't lay the blame solely at the foot of employers, which I think is what they were suggesting. The blame, if anything, has to go back in the household, where decisions about who works in the paid workforce, who works at home, etc. And in our society, the stay-at-home dads are very much a minority. But if the stay-at-home dads were, you know, 50% of the households, this gender gap would close a lot.
It was reported that you actually also were talking about the preferred hours and the preferred labour setup of couples with children, and you were actually suggesting, or it was reported you were suggesting, that most men and women prefer things the way they are and actually don't want a gender reversal, so that dads are working part-time and being stay-at-home dads and mums are out there working 70 hours a week and overtime. Where do you draw that from?
Well, I'm not sure I actually said that, but however, if I had, I don't think I'd retract from it. I mean, the bottom line is there's plenty of evidence, including, for example, the very large-scale Hilda survey that the government funds that I'm the director of, which collects data about working hours preferences. And it's very clear that the way people are, the choices they make today, still very much, on average, favours a fairly traditional, maybe neo-traditional model, whereby the man is the primary breadwinner and the woman tends to be not necessarily stay at home, but a part-time worker, you know, sort of a part-career, part-time worker. So that is still the traditional model. That's not saying that these things can't change, but it requires big changes in society to change it. Now, we are, of course, seeing changes in the sense that, obviously, coming out of university education, men and women are very much on a par now. Despite what the minister said, starting salaries really are and no different. But it's still the case that that in our society, for all sorts of reasons, that women, on average, again, we're talking about averages, more likely to prefer part-time work. They're more likely to want to take time out when children are around that come along. They're more likely to want to take, assume the role as the primary caregiver.
And do you think that there's some differences in age here? Do you think that for the under 30s or for people before they start families, there's a much more equity between men and women, and it's really in their 30s or when families come along that this pay gap seems to develop? Yeah.
Absolutely. As I just said, that when they come out of university, really the differences in starting salaries are non-existent. I mean, I did some research from quite some years ago, just cross-sectional data, which showed that when you look at the gender pay gap for people under 30, there was no gap. At least, in fact, if there was anything, it probably favoured the young women. But basically, the differences were so tiny that we can say they were naught. But as they move into their 30s and 40s, you know, very large gaps open up. So that's consistent with the idea that something happens as they enter their child bearing years and as their careers develop. Returning to the issue of starting salaries, the Minister Tanya Plibersek pointed to GradStats figures that shows the $3,000 difference. But what she didn't alert the audience to was that there's other research undertaking using the graduate starting salaries data, which subjects it to more rigorous analysis. For example, one of the things you must control is whether the young graduates, how many hours they're going to work in their new job. And by and large, again, the new graduates coming into the workforce, the men are more likely to opt for longer working hours jobs than the women. And also the types of fields and the types of professions they enter into. Okay, a classic case is medicine. There are lots and lots of female medical graduates. In fact, they're outnumbering the men, but they're not choosing the high-earning end of the profession. So they're going into GP practice, etc., general practice, and they're not going for the, you know, the big specialties where perhaps, you know, longer hours required, for example, for the first 5-6 years of establishing yourself. So when you do all that sort of analysis, you get graduate starting salary differences of nil.
We might just take a short break. Mark Wooden, it's great to have you on the show, and we'll be back very shortly.
Break out and seek freedom, 'cause then you'll live both. 'Cause there's always
we're talking with Professor Mark Wooden from the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research, and he's also the head of what's known as HILDA, which is the largest ever survey conducted into household incomes and the way Australians basically organise their lives. Just to backtrack a bit, Mark, most families are happy with this situation where the bloke works full-time and the woman works part-time after the kids come along.
Seems to be the case. I mean, wouldn't say it's universal, but that does seem... It's very efficient.
Yes. Okay,
the idea that both of you go into the workforce full-time to pursue careers when you've got family and lots of demands from the family doesn't quite work because...
It's just impossible.
Both of you miss out on the promotions, or you've got to have, you know, full-time nannies. So, of course, the wealthy can afford it. But the average Australian, it's not that efficient.
And also, there's a huge, pay bonus in working overtime and those extra hours as opposed to regular hour work. So if no one's working that overtime, which has a premium on it, if the man and the woman work 25 hours each, if the man actually worked 50 hours... he'd earn more because he's earning overtime.
The thing to make clear, though, is when we talk about... they don't mostly, unless you're working down a coal mine or something, mostly you're not getting paid traditional overtime. The rewards come years later. The rewards come
from experience
in promotion.
Yeah.
Okay, so you work these long hours, then you get promoted, you get into the big Vicky, you know, sort of jobs, and that's when you're on these big salaries.
Mark, have you been surprised by the response to this? I mean, the reporting goes that you were greeted with gasps when you made this suggestion that really women, if they want to earn the same money, should earn the, work the same hours.
Oh, if I'm surprised, I guess that just reveals how naive I am.
Did you think that maybe things had moved on a bit?
Yeah, I did actually. I thought it was sort of, you know, that we'd grown up. And I thought also growing up meant there's sort of, we went through this period where we became very politically correct. And I thought we overdid it, and so maybe I thought that these things sort of change, and we can now look at these things a little bit more level-headed. But clearly, there are strong gender divides in some of these things. And also, I guess, you know, I think some other people on the panel, I mean, Heather Riddart's classic case, I think she really agrees with most of what I had to say, but she's very tactful, very politic, able to dance around these issues without offending people, where I guess I was a bit more like a sledgehammer.
Well, she did say that a lot of men, you're basically right, and a lot of men had been well promoted beyond their ability and encouraging women to be more aggressive. So.
Yeah. Well, the thing about that ability, that's a bit funny, isn't it? The point there is that, of course, you know, if we just rewarded people on their innate ability, well, then we just make someone the direct, you know, the head of the company as soon as they've left university. Just do an IQ test. But that's just crazy. We know experience, wisdom, you know, experience life matters a lot. Okay, you think of it just about most skilled professions. And that's also why in the unskilled, in the low-paid jobs, there's other research done by lots of people, not me, which shows that the pay gap is mostly a sort of a high-earning job phenomenon. Okay, amongst the very low skilled, they're on award wages. The award wages require that men and women are paid the same. There's very little evidence that women do badly relative to men in low-paid jobs. It's only in the high-pay end, in the middle to high-earning jobs, where these things become significant.
It's amazing, isn't it, the furor that still attaches to all this. I mean, we've copped a bit of it doing Dads on the Air, that if you dare to speak up for dads, you're somehow against women, whereas this
or you're targeted as some sort of right-wing conservative, where nothing could be further from the case.
Oh, dear.
So, Mark, you've written previously on that earnings are actually only one of the reasons why people choose various professions, and that men actually may place a higher value on the monetary value of their jobs, and women actually may choose jobs for other reasons. Do you want to go into that?
Well, I think all of us, money matters, but it's how much it matters. Okay, so we all put different weight on different things, and I think on average, again, you tend to find that women are much more likely, again, we're dealing with averages, to put greater weight on, for example, family. They may well have better balanced lives as a result. Men are more likely to put weight on paid work. Women are more likely to put weight on flexibility in the hours that they're offered when they do work. So it's one thing saying I'm prepared to work, you know, a full-time job, but at the same time, they want a job that offers flexibility in those hours. So as a result, they're prepared to maybe accept a pay cut in in conversation for those jobs. In the same way that, you know, that all jobs, you know, you get premiums and penalties depending on the conditions. So we expect, if you're going to work down a dangerous coal mine, we expect there to be a premium there. Otherwise, you won't attract the workers. So men are prepared to go for the premium. That premium, for danger, for example, appears to be generally less attractive for women. Okay, you tend not to find them working in so many jobs where, you know, your life is at risk. So these sorts of things do matter, and they seem to reflect innate preferences that do seem to differ with the gender. Despite big change in society over time, men and women are different. That Venus and Mars thing again.
Absolutely. Another thing I want to put to you, you may or may not have any knowledge of this area, but all the time in the media we hear about how much men earn and how much women earn and this pay gap in earnings. Do you actually know of any studies that actually look at how much men and women spend, so spending power as opposed to earning power? Because that to me gets more to the bottom of these differences of power between the genders. Do you actually know whether, in terms of who spends the money, do you have any evidence on that?
Not really, but I think, I mean, the question's sort of, you know, a little bit loaded perhaps. I mean, when we're dealing with, for example, couples, most couples sort of make decisions sort of jointly. So even the decision about how many hours, you know, hubby's going to work, in many households, the female has an input into that.
Absolutely.
So therefore, expenditure, you can, you know, who spends the money? I mean, I don't think it really matters in most households. These are joint things. So, you know, the wife might actually be doing most of the purchasing because she has, that's part of her sort of duties. That's part of what she's doing when she's not in paid work, because she's doing less paid work. But these are mostly household decisions. So when we're talking about couples, and I think even decisions about work really are household decisions. So it doesn't really matter who, you know, if you talk about it from perspective of a household, these things don't really matter. I guess one reason why many women do get upset is decisions about careers, etc., do matter in the event of a divorce. And unfortunately, most of us make decisions, quite correctly, we make decisions based on, you know, living, marriage being sort of continuing forever. But unfortunately, that we know doesn't happen. And when you get divorces, the problem is that the even with our new laws, which mean the man must split his super, etc., but the man has still got a career and he continue on earning high money, the woman now finds that she sacrificed her career along the way, and therefore her ability to start earning more on her own is dramatically less than the man.
Mind you, the fathers are dramatically disadvantaged in custody battles because they claim that they're not the so-called primary carer because they've been
absolutely
at work.
Absolutely. There are other inequities which have got to, that's absolutely true.
I just wanted to bring up the issue of the increasing gap between men and women in our education system now. The latest grad stats survey shows that in terms of just the pure number of graduates from undergraduate degrees in 2006 showed that there were almost 50% more women than men graduating from Australia's universities. So obviously we're getting more and more women getting that level of education compared to men. Do you think that that is going to bring about a shift in earnings, possibly emphasised in the under 30s, that perhaps the women are going to be earning a lot more than men in decades to come? Or do you think these social choices that people seem to make may adjust for that?
Well, a couple of responses, I guess. I mean, the first thing, I'm surprised by those figures. I didn't realise the gap had turned quite so dramatically. But leaving that aside, the thing we do know is that since the equal pay case of the early and mid-70s, those two big cases, the gender pay gap in Australia has really not changed for 30 years, yet the educational outcomes of men and women have been changing.
Have almost flipped on their head.
Exactly. So, so they've changed dramatically, yet the gender pay gap doesn't seem to have moved. Now, maybe it's still just a lagged effect. There's still most of these young women have not reached the sort of middle-aged, older women stage, but I don't think so. So I would have expected to see the gender pay gap for that reason narrow. So the key reason is, again, I think that choices that we make are still very traditional. And again, the classic case, the figure that I cited that didn't go down too well, is that 25% of employed men are working 50 hours or more. 8% of women are working 50 hours or more. Now, the inference was that all people should be working 50 hours or more. That's not what I was saying. What I was saying is while we have that particular arrangement, men are likely to continue to earn a lot more than women.
And you're seeing a lot of this in Sydney, of course, where the mortgages are so astonishingly high that men are just working excruciatingly long hours, basically to hold the body and soul of the family together. It's really having quite a deleterious effect, I think, on a lot of men in this city, at least.
Well, the good news, at least, is that from that perspective, at least over the last 5 or 6 years, the proportion of men and women, but mostly men, who are working those long hours does seem to have declined, okay, a little bit. Okay, let's not overstate it, but there's still lots of men working those long hours. So it does seem to be in the right direction, but how long that will sustain, I think it's got a lot to do with the economy, that the economy's been strong, delivering strong real wage increases. You don't need to quite work so hard, but if the economy, you know, is about to do a U-turn, which, you know, we're not sure it is, but it's certainly not looking as bright as it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, then, you know, I mean, I think one of the reasons that people do work those long hours is also for sort of job security reasons. The man's got that prime breadwinner role. He doesn't want to lose, you know, his job. He doesn't want to lose the, you know, the high earnings that he's perhaps currently getting. So
they really have to work those sort of long hours.
I mean, they're working to impress. I mean, it's part of the issue. And I think in the last 5 years, that's been less of a factor because the job market has been so strong.
And partly, I suppose, because of the influence of women in the modern workplace.
Possibly so, yeah, I don't know. Don't know about that.
We're running out of time, but just before you go, just the whole Hilda survey, which we haven't really covered a lot on this program, I just wondered if you could give a really quick summary of where it's all at the moment. It's a multi-million dollar exercise.
The largest survey of income, et cetera. It's not quite right. Its key defining feature is it's a longitudinal survey. And that's its unique feature, is that we're not just surveying a whole bunch of people once, and then next time we come along and survey a whole bunch of different people. We're studying the same people. The people out there who are part of it, you might know it better as Living in Australia. But we're following people over time. So I guess it's sort of like that 7-Up program, but gone mad, because we're not interviewing 50 or 60 people. We're interviewing 14,000 people. We're not interviewing them every 7 years. We're coming back and talking to them every year. So, you know, it's a big-scale project and is following people through their lives. So it's a study of change and also the study of things that don't change. It's just as important to the stability in people's lives as the change in it.
And what are the major findings so far?
Well, it's difficult to put that all out in a couple of minutes. Impossible to do.
Right.
Check out our website at themelbourneinstitute.com for a huge bibliography about all the sorts of things people are doing. We collect the data, and then the data is made available after a certain degree of sanitisation to researchers in universities and in government. It's been used for all sorts of things, studying the effects of marriage and divorce, how happy people feel, the factors determining life satisfaction, the role income, social security changes have been making. It's been used to sort of evaluate in a crude sort of way policy changes, okay, on different subgroups in the population. It's certainly not perfect. There are certain segments of the society that we don't cover. The homeless don't get a Guernsey, but it is big and it is pretty representative of the most of the largest, the key groups in our society.
Right, we're out of time. Is there any closing words you'd like to say on becoming a sort of mini celebrity in the gender debates of Australia this week?
I hope, you know, we get a bit sensitive about some things. This seems to be one of them, and I just hope that we can all keep a level head, and that way you won't discourage people like me from putting our views across. I think we do have something to contribute.
Fantastic. Okay, that was Professor Mark Wooden. He's from the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research and also the director of HILDA, the survey that's tracking 14,000 people's lives. Look, thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
It's been my pleasure.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by. and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you. And you, of tender years, that your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they
And we're talking with Warwick Marsh from the Fatherhood Foundation. Welcome to the show, Warwick.
It's great to be back on. Dad's on the Air. What a great song you had. That's one of my favourites. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Teach Your Children Well.
You're a saint. You will be a saint, you know.
Are you sure about that, John? Saint John, I should call you.
Pretty sure.
Saint John, I don't know if John would qualify for being a saint. I think you just sort of keep that mantle all to yourself there, Warwick.
Mate.
My mum's listening to this show. You be careful.
So, Warwick, we were talking earlier in the show about this move to remove father from New South Wales birth certificates to, well, they say it's going to make children grow up better adjusted. We've failed to see the link there. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's exactly the same problem. It's on the grounds that they're trying to make it easier and better for lesbians to have children and to et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is that as soon as you remove fathers from the equation, because it always takes a male and a female to have a child, and, of course, this is the sort of thing they're trying to basically, disallow and to
gloss over, pretend it doesn't happen.
It's basically pretending that it does not take a man and a woman to create a child. And, of course, all the statistics show us and all the studies show us that children grow up best in a relationship between a man and a woman, a committed relationship, marriage for life. And, of course, as soon as children get out of that loop, there was just a recent study that was only last week, the week before, that a university researcher in Melbourne released a study that showed that children who get away from their biological father 17 times, and in fact, when we did an interview with him and just checked his facts and figures, it was actually closer to 77 times, which is much more closer to all the other studies around the world, that children basically are likely to die in those situations. I'm talking about death now, fatalities from accidents or from harm. And lesbian relationships are well known to be violent relationships. In fact, homosexual relationships, generally speaking, are often more violent. than heterosexual relationships. And so we're letting children into these relationships, and the law is actually sanctioning this and encouraging it, and I find that an abomination.
Here's a suggestion for you. I think let them remove the word father from the birth certificates when lesbians are able to actually get pregnant without a father. As long as they need sperm from a father, which means children have a father, then they have to have father on the birth certificate. Once they actually are able to have children without a father, then let them remove it. But these kids that come from the lesbian couple with in vitro fertilisation or sperm donation, they have a father. I'm sorry, those women didn't spontaneously produce this child. There is a father, and that child will grow up wanting to know about their history and wanting to know about their paternal side of their family.
Yeah, look, every child longs to, just last week in Fathers Online, as a young man, 23, 24 years of age, and he is still devastated because he never met his father. His father turned to alcohol. He was a prison warder. He had problems. A guy shot him, and obviously he probably had maybe a wounding from his past past relationships. Well, the long and short of it was that Brendan never ever met his biological father, and thankfully, at 11 years of age, he was put in with a foster home with a father and a mother who cared for him, and they were committed to each other, committed to him, and are committed to their family. He had a stable relationship. But even now, as a young man, he still longs to know his father. So how can we actually stand by and let a government bring in laws that basically encourage a fatherless society and, as you point out so ably, Greg, actually lie to us? It's just legal lying. That's what it amounts to.
Yeah, it's just rubbish. Look, the article that I read from this morning, I mean, it goes on to say, gay and lesbian rights lobby spokeswoman Emily Gray said the changes would give children the emotional and financial stability that comes with the legal recognition of their families, particularly in times of illness, at the death of a parent, or at the breakdown of a parental relationship. I mean, this is talking about lesbian couples. I mean, what about normal couples? You know, I mean, this is less than 1%. Why do we have to change everything for this, for less than 1%, what is really an anomaly in the family model that you know that we are expressing here in this country? Why should an anomaly take precedence over the basically, you know, the common garden bread and butter way of doing things for the last billion years? I mean,
and all of those problems that they just mentioned that lesbian families may have around separation, divorce, and all of that sort of thing are experienced a million times more by normal heterosexual couples. Why not fix up those problems first?
Yeah, look, it's you know, that's the ironic thing, of course, is that men are experiencing shocking discrimination. We're talking about the men. Now, men, the male of the species, 49.2% of the population, the biggest minority group in the nation, are experiencing enormous travesties of justice and wrong vilification and basically their children are taken from them under the pretext of best interest of the child. And there's a case of classic case of you know, bad law gone even worse. And of course, this is bad law, really bad law, which could go even worse. And it literally, it's a derogation of marriage, it's a derogation of men, it's a derogation of fathers and families. And of course, ultimately, it deprives children. It's a form of child abuse, that the government should be actually making laws to make it illegal for a woman to have a child without a committed man involved in the picture.
A father. Let's use the word, the F word, a father.
Yep, it's not a four-letter word either, is it?
No, it's a good word, and we should polish it up and hold it up there in its place of glory that it should have in our society and in every society, because fathers are the backbone of every society.
Yep, you take the male of the species out of society, derogate him, you basically can destroy the society. We need to applaud women, we need to applaud femininity, but we also need a healthy, strong, virile masculinity that is caring, responsible, gracious and kind and considerate. And when we encourage that, we'll actually turn our society around from the disaster we're heading for. It's like we're heading for a cliff, and it's just like, it's all systems go and there's no brakes on. And,
well, we're applauding them. I mean, why aren't they applauding us? This is not applauding men. This is, you know, sure, we can applaud women. Women are great. They do a fantastic job. They're, you know, they're the best at being women that anybody could possibly be. But, hey, we're men and we're really good at being men, and it's a really important thing to have in society. And how about some applause back our way? Fatherhood should be honoured, not scrubbed off the birth certificate.
And you mentioned that 1%, the reality of the figure, actually, it's more like 0.1%. 1%, 0.2 of 1% of lesbian couples in Australia. I mean, that's sort of the ratio of lesbian couples in Australia.
That's not lesbian couples having children. That's just lesbian couples, yeah?
Well, we're actually talking about lesbian couples, 0.1 of 0.2 of 1% with couples with children.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's a very minute figure in the big picture. And we basically are making laws which are derogating everything else. And, of course, there's a real problem here with inheritances. When you start changing birth certificates and start playing funny buggers with the words on the birth certificate, what's going to happen to the inheritance of their children? I mean, you've got ridiculous situations in West Australia where either mother can claim to be the mother, doesn't have to be the real mother, and because they've gone through this process already, and of course it's becoming an absolute legal nightmare.
Well, and also they're in those cases where two women split and there's a child involved, they are more prepared to accept the presumption of equal shared parenting at separation than they are with a heterosexual couple where one of them happens to be a bloke.
It's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. Isn't it? And of course, the other problem too is that lesbian relationships are three or four times more volatile than normal heterosexual relationships. And so, you know, a little child could end up having about 50 mothers or 20 mothers or 5 mothers, in its lifetime, which can be quite horrific, besides the fact that, it hasn't got a father. It's got this endless stream of mothers going through its life, and, of course, it just becomes a revolving door.
I'm going to just bring up the slippery slope argument here. Where's it going to end? Okay, if we're no longer having mums and dads as the parents of our kids, why don't we just make the birth certificate blank slate and say, well, have a threesome raising a child, or maybe a farmer and his sheep raising a child.
Dog, I mean, and a cat.
Yeah, where do you stop once you introduce this? Why can't anyone? Let's just have a group, of 50 random people raise a child. Put them all on the birth certificate. I mean, it's crazy stuff.
It's crazy stuff, Greg. As I was talking to you the other day, in Spain, they've actually the really radical left wing ratbag government has actually brought in. On the birth certificates, it's progenitor 1 and progenitor 2, so they've just disallowed mother and father completely. And so it'll be progenitor 1, progenitor 2. And, of course, as you said, this is a slippery slope. Basically, the next step is gay marriage. The next step after that is the total androgenisation of society, where even to talk about males and females it becomes a mortal sin. And fathers and mothers are long gone. And, of course, our children are the losers. The children are always the losers in this sort of politically correct nonsense. And
right.
The children become sacrificial lambs.
We've been talking with Warwick Marsh from the Fatherhood Foundation.
Or should we say the Progenitor Onehood Foundation?
So, can I just say something very quickly? On the 3rd of June, 10 o'clock, from 10 o'clock to 1:30, 3rd of June at Parliament, we're having a protest rally. We're calling it Dads for Kids. Dads for Kids, and we'll keep you posted, but we'd certainly love your support, and we'd love to have a speaker from Dads on Air if they're able to come along and put the case that men indeed are the endangered species.
Well, there is a range of views on this program and in this studio. We'll certainly be getting the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby onto the show to put their point of view, and we'll be back in a moment.
You're actually about to play a track of Warwick's here. This is a track called Daddy Don't Live Here No More, courtesy of Warwick Marsh and family.
Don't come knocking on my front door. Tell him how I feel.
welcome back to Dad's on the Air. On the line from the US, we have with us Richard B. Felsen, and Richard is the Professor of Crime, Law and Justice and Sociology at Pennsylvania State University. Richard, thank you so much for coming on the program.
I'm glad to be on.
Now, I'm just going to read a little paragraph from an article that you wrote in Context, a journal, which is the Journal of the American Sociological Association. You wrote, suppose a group of men murdered millions of women. Before doing so, they shaved their heads, stripped them, and sometimes beat and sexually assaulted them. Would this be an appalling example of sexism? Not necessarily. The Nazis committed these deeds, but they killed millions of men as well. If we ignore their violence against men and only look at that against women, their behaviour appears to reflect sexism. Perhaps this same kind of selective focus affects our understanding of violence against women today. Are the offenders sexist or just violent men? Are women victimised because of their gender or because they make up half the population? Now, this article basically challenges what you call the gender perspective on violence and on domestic violence, and you espouse what you call a violence perspective. Would you like to outline a little bit of those two differing perspectives for us?
Okay. The gender perspective, which is basically the feminist perspective, is to focus just on violence against women and to study it separately and to not make comparisons to violence against men and to not make comparisons of domestic violence to other forms of violence. And my perspective, which I call in this article the violence perspective, says, well, you have to make comparisons to find out in what ways it, violence against women or violence against wives is special. There may be special aspects of it, but you've got to show it, not assume it. And it says you have to take a scientific approach to it and let the evidence show what it shows. This is an area that's been dominated by activists, and they make many misleading statements. So I'm pushing a more of a violence perspective. There are some people who are more violent than others, and men tend to be more violent than women generally, and that sometimes culminates in violence against wives. But there's also violence against husbands, and you need to make comparisons to see if there are special motives, to see if we tolerate it more. A lot of people get away with violence without getting arrested, but are people, men who are violent against their wives, are they particularly likely to get away with it? Is that type of crime particularly unlikely to be reported? Those are questions you have to ask.
So do you think that this the feminist view that we've basically has become the general view in Western societies over the last 30 years that, you know, violence against women is a special problem, and we have an epidemic of battered women, and we constantly hear in the media about, you know, wife beating and survivors and this horrific, horrific violence as if it's the sort of violence that occurs every day. Do you think that is not based on science? Do you think that approach is based instead on political activism and on social activism?
Yes, I do. Of course, there is some very serious violence against wives and
of
against
course.
Women, but there's lots of serious violence against men. And it's important when you, for example, say there's an epidemic and you count, you got to be careful. What are you counting? You know, most crime and most violence against women is minor, and most violence against men is minor. So what they'll do sometimes is they'll count all the minor acts and then give it a very serious label. They'll call it wife beating. Well, wife beating occurs, but they count pushes and shoves and then call that wife beating, or they say it's a battered wife. Or sometimes the people on the other side, sometimes they'll say they're battered husbands. And in science, you have to use careful language. There are battered wives and husbands, but use the word battered when they are battered. Use the word beating when there is an actual beating, that is, somebody repeatedly hits somebody. But what they do is they count the minor stuff to get big numbers, and then they give it a very serious label, which is just misleading.
Now, I'd like to discuss some of the specific studies that you've done, which have really been quite rigorous. The first is talking about control in relationships. Basically, the feminist position is that men engage in more marital violence than wives because they're more controlling, and mm-hmm. this is all about power and control and the Duluth model and all of this sort of thing.
Right.
Now, you've, I believe, run a study which showed that, well, it suggests that husbands and wives may differ in their methods of control, but not their motivation to control.
Yes. You know, people have different... You've got to think about what are the motives for violence, generally. And control is one motive. People will use violence to influence other people. But they also use violence to save face and make themselves look good. They also use violence because they think it's a form of justice or retribution, and the person, the victim deserves it or the target deserves it. So there are various motives. So you have to consider all of those motives. And those can be motives within the family and outside the family. And they can be the motives of both men and women. And one question you might ask, well, are men more controlling than women? And there's no evidence. Our evidence suggests that women are just as controlling as men in marriages, and that, therefore, it's not a matter of, well, men hitting their wives because they want to control them. Some of them might do that, but some women might have that motive when they hit their husbands. Now, men are, one key difference is men tend to be bigger and stronger. So if they're trying to control, they can use violence more successfully to get their way, although there are many repercussions. But I say then it's a difference in method between men and women, not a difference in motive. And men can use it as a method more because they're bigger. And, you know, you have to think about when a man and a woman get married, you've got one party who's much bigger than the other, usually. And so, you know, you're going to have instances where men mistreat their wives physically and can hurt them seriously. But in fact, you probably are aware of this, that women actually hit their husbands as often as men hit their wives, but just not with as much effect.
Yeah, also, women tend to be more sneaky. A man will go toe-to-toe, front up, and belt you, whereas a woman will wait till you're not looking, you've got your back turned or whatever, and then she will tend to arm herself, and she'll come in when you're not expecting it and let you have it big time, kind of one hit. She needs to take you out, whereas, you know, it's a different sort of dynamic for a violence if you're a big, strong man attacking a little, weak woman, as opposed to a little, weak woman attacking a big, strong man. The dynamic is completely different.
Well, you know, women, though, will hit men as often as men will hit their wives. And I think, in these fights, some of them involve mutual violence, and it's not men who are more likely to initiate the violence than women. It's about the same. And I think that women initiate violence more than you might expect with their husbands because they count on a norm of chivalry. And chivalry is very important in this discussion because, you know, we learned as kids, I mean, I learned and most males learn, don't hit girls. And this is a major factor in explaining why men are much more likely to be victims of violence than women generally.
Well, also, men will protect women. I mean, if you're playing, you know, if you're in a pub or something and someone tries to hit on your girlfriend or someone insults your girlfriend, it will be a man who rushes to her defense.
Absolutely.
While the woman runs away, perhaps she seeks refuge and safety while the man stands there and defends whatever.
Right. My father used to tell me, if you go to a bar, a rough bar, don't go with a girl. You're going to have to defend her, and you're more likely to get into a fight because you're required to be chivalrous. You know, chivalry has just been ignored in this whole discussion, but it is critical. People don't like the notion of chivalry because it implies a woman is weak, and this is not a new thing. When the Titanic went down and they let the women and children off first, there were some women's groups who applauded the men and built a statue to honor them, and there are other women's groups who complained about this notion of chivalry and that it implied a dependent image for females. So this is not new, this ambivalence of people about chivalry, but it is a very real thing. We punish people worse for hitting a woman than hitting a man. It's not that we tolerate violence against women. We treat it more severely in the criminal justice system.
There's been an amazing amount of hysteria in Australia over the recent years with multi-million-dollar public campaigns, Australia Says No to Violence Against Women, and these sort of things. Is it a similar situation in America?
Yes, it is similar. I mean, the Violence Against Women Act, there's lots of attention and hysteria. I think that's probably true. I mean, not to say this isn't a problem, and that we, you know, societies go and for a long time have taken steps to try to protect women from their husbands because they can be vulnerable because they're weaker, and there are some violent men. I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, we've got criminal offenders who commit violence. Well, why we shouldn't be surprised that these people might be violent with their wives. And, of course, that does happen. But I tend to look at these offenders more as offenders. And one of the findings in criminology is that most violent offenders are versatile, we call them. They don't specialize. They don't specialize in violence against women. Those who are violent against women are also violent against men. And
you find, likewise, I think, with women who are violent, they're just as likely to have criminal records.
The women who kill their husbands are just as likely to have criminal records as the women who kill other people, who kill women, for example.
Look, the biggest confusion in this whole debate is the frequency of it. And, I mean, we have people saying that, you know, only 2% of women are battered, or 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 or 1 in 5. Or what is the actual figure?
Well, it's very difficult to say because you've got to these figures are way off. But they're using the word battered or beating to describe pushes and shoves. And once they see, what they did was they started counting the minor stuff to get big numbers. But then Murray Strauss and some people, family violence researchers, counted the minor stuff by women. And once you count the minor stuff, the women look just as violent as the men. So they caught all the female fish along with the male fish in their broad net. But once you get to the more serious stuff, then you get asymmetry. Men are more likely to injure their wives than wives are to injure their husbands. But, you know, one of the interesting things about this is men, in general, are 8 times more likely to commit violence, generally. But in the family, there's parity. They're about the same, just as likely, no more likely than women to hit their spouse. So we shouldn't be asking why do men hit their wives. We should be asking why don't they hit them more often, given the fact that men tend to be 8 times more violent than women.
Which once again points to the chivalry principle.
Absolutely. So when I say, why don't they hit it more, I'm not saying they should. I'm saying, you know, there's something inhibiting them. Even Richard, the Iceman, the Richard Kluginski, who killed a couple hundred people, he was even inhibited, he said. He admitted to a lot of his violence, but he said violence against his wife was the one thing he wouldn't even talk about. He said, but he was embarrassed about it. He wasn't embarrassed about any of the 200 people he had killed, men. So it's something that's very important in this discussion that is ignored, this chivalry, this norm protecting women.
We're talking with Richard B. Felsen from the Pennsylvania State University. We're going to go to a music track and we'll be back in a moment.
Don't be so hard on yourself. Those tears are for someone else. I hear your voice on the phone. I hear you feel so alone, my baby. Oh, my baby, please, my baby, my baby. So long ago,
What's become of them? When you feel like me, I want you to know. Don't cry, not alone. Don't cry tonight, my baby. Friends I had before, and I wonder why the ones who care don't call anymore. My feelings hurt, but you know I overcome the pain, and I'm stronger now. There can't be a fire less than the flame. Don't cry. Now the warmth in my that we've had enough. Don't feel alone, 'cause it's all you understand. I'm your sedative. Take a piece of me whenever you can. Don't cry.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. On the line from the States, we have with us still Richard B. Felsen from Pennsylvania State University. Richard, I might read another little paragraph from your piece in the Contexts Journal. It's talking about rape frequency. You write, An even more heated debate concerns the frequency of rape. One prominent survey carried out by Mary Koss asked American college students about their sexual experiences since the age of 14. It found that about 9% of college women reported they had engaged in sexual intercourse because a man threatened or used some degree of physical force, twisting your arm, holding you down, etc., to make you. But now only 27% of those women thought of these incidents as rape. Now, scholars with the gender perspective, the feminist perspective, think that these victims buy into rape myths, blaming themselves or thinking that the term rape applies only when those offenders are strangers. Now, those with a violence perspective, that's the one that you're espousing, suggest that many of these encounters are actually ambiguous. They note that many of the women attribute these incidents to misunderstandings. Now, we've had changes and proposed changes to the rape laws in three states of Australia that basically use the very blunt instrument of the law to define certain acts as rape when they may actually have been some of these misunderstandings.
These are ambiguous encounters sometimes, and so I don't really believe any counts or any when somebody says there's this many rapes. I think it's too hard to tell. I think there's a lot of ambiguity, as you mentioned from my article. And, you know, you have women engaging in token resistance sometimes, saying no when they mean yes or maybe. And so it's difficult to say on many of these. And I think with the alcohol thing, unless the woman is unconscious, one can't assume that sex with a woman who's been drinking is rape. You know, many of us drink, and we can still make decisions.
And why is it rape for the woman and not for the man? I mean, if the man's been drinking as well...
We don't give him an excuse. Oh, I did it, yeah, but I was drinking, so I'm not responsible for my behavior. You know, I robbed the bank, but I was drunk. I mean, you know. Now, it may be if a woman's very intoxicated, we might say to a guy, well, don't have sex. It's ungentlemanly, or it's taking advantage of someone to have sex with her.
Especially if he's not drunk and she's drunk.
If he's not drunk. But that doesn't mean you put him in jail. That's a whole different matter. In other words, obnoxious behavior is different from criminal behavior. And you might argue that men should not have sex with a woman if she's too intoxicated, but that's not criminal unless she's unconscious. Now, it's ambiguous sometimes, you know, to what degree must she be drunk before you say she can't make decisions? So, I don't know. That's hard to say.
And what about false allegations of rape? Do you have any figures on those? Do you know whether false allegations of rape are greater or less than false allegations of other crimes?
I think it's pretty clear that they're more likely to have false allegations for rape than other crimes. And there have been some studies of it. Now, the feminists cite a source, they say, that shows the opposite, or shows that there's no difference, but the source doesn't really exist. It was made up. The real studies of it show it's very common. Now, the good news is that it was just one study that showed, you know, that 40% of the charges were the woman recanted. It's hard to believe it's that high, but it did show that. And the good news, though, is that usually the police found out very quickly that it was a false charge and dropped the charge. But it is a problem, and we have to be careful on this because people can make false charges.
And how do you think the laws could be drafted in such a way that they can deal with the issue of false allegations? Do you think that the law is basically too blunt an instrument to figure out these sort of subtleties, and that it's actually the training of the police or the culture of police that we should be looking at more than the law reform in order to make the law deal with these issues of rape in a more subtle way?
Well, my impression, it's been written that the police are question carefully on these things, and they themselves think that some of these charges are false and that they pay attention to that. And so, and the law is going to have to, I don't know how the law can be changed. you have to, someone makes a charge of rape, and you have to examine it carefully and look for evidence. But so I think they still have to prosecute, but the decision has to be made whether the victim is, the woman is telling the truth, and not assume she is. But you know, it's a tough issue. But they still have to address it and address it in the courts if they think the charge is valid.
Okay. Now, one of the more controversial things that you write about is actually that special protections for women may actually be warranted because of women's vulnerability, even if the evidence shows that the violence is similar. It's actually women's vulnerability that may actually mean that special protections are warranted. Now, this is obviously something that the feminists would be up in arms about, implying that women are somehow weak or dependent or vulnerable. But, you know, you do say evidence shows that women's fear of rape leads them to curb their activities much more often than men do. Women, basically, given the same set of violent circumstances or potential for violence, women do seem to be affected a lot more than men. Do you want to outline that a bit for our listeners?
Okay, well, I think there's a dilemma because, you know, we all believe in equal justice before the law. And if a man hits his wife, a woman hits her husband, same act, same injury, you know, we think that they should get the same punishment. But, or maybe, you know, if he should be arrested, then she should be arrested for the same thing. On the other hand, I mean, we all believe in equal justice, but on the other hand, we might be more concerned with her protection, given that he's usually bigger. And so we might be more likely to arrest him, someone could make the argument, because one of the goals of the law is to protect the victim. So there might be a tendency to discriminate in that instance. And I don't know the answer to this, but I pointed out as a dilemma, equal justice versus the desire to protect a victim, which might lead you to be more aggressive against the male offender than the female offender. You know, in general, the law is more aggressive against male offenders in general than female offenders. There's this chivalry, but you know, there's a rational basis to chivalry too. I guess feminists don't like that, but you know, even in primitive societies, they've shown, you know, they worry about women with their husbands mistreating them, and they have protectors for them. You know, I think there is a difference in strength between men and women, and we might take some special efforts to protect women. I don't object to that myself.
Now, if one of the reasons that women are affected more by certain sorts of violence is that they are perhaps a bit more vulnerable, a bit more fearful of these things occurring, do you think that so-called public health measures that trumpet out to everyone that, you know, 1 in 3 women is a victim of rape and 1 in 2 women is a victim of domestic violence, or not only domestic violence but battering and beating and actually trumpeting this hysteria about violence against women, do you think that may actually add to women's fearfulness and actually be counterproductive rather than actually, you know, reassuring women, making women more confident, less fearful, less vulnerable, which may actually be better for them?
Well, it's I'm not sure what the answer to that is. They did it to get more money and to get more attention to the problem, and it worked that way. Now, one of the problems when you mislead and make up statistics or present misleading statistics is you lose your credibility after a while. it does make women more fearful. And also another possible problem could be that it's described as so severe that women might think their victimization is even worse than it is. Emphasize the negative because it's described as a fate worse rape, for example, describing as a fate worse than death. You know, and then someone's raped, and you know that's going to have a bigger effect on them if they think of it that way than if they think of it, well, I'm the victim of a crime and I can recover from this. But so there are different effects. I don't know overall whether. I mean, generally, you know, when you're using a control model, for example, this Duluth model, when it's all based, it's not based on any science, and it doesn't work, and it's in, you know, it's bogus, and it's not going to help with counseling or you might have a victim who thinks, who learns this idealistic version of a woman. She's a survivor and she's a heroine.
Mm.
And most victims know they're not that. And maybe that makes it worse for them. I don't know. Maybe.
Richard, we're running straight right out of time. Just to close, is the whole debate on domestic violence changing, do you think, or coming back to a more sensible level, or is it still largely hysterical?
I think it's slowly changing.
And common
now,
sense
I
is coming back.
I can't predict what's going to happen. But there are more and more people casting doubt on this this gender approach, the feminist approach, and I see more and more scholars doing it. It is a cost to it because still the dominant view is that it's sexism and oppression of women.
And if you dare say that it's not the patriarchy oppressing women, then you cop a sentence, basically, or a consequence in the university environment.
Absolutely. There's a price that I have to pay.
And it's a price all of us had to pay for speaking out.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Professor Richard Felsen. He's from the Department of Crime, Law, Justice and Sociology at the Pennsylvania State University in America. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
All righty. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And
bye.
Next week, we'll have Richard Farr from K-Rights Radio on the program. He's a great talker and been a guest on to Dad's on the Air previously. And also Toni McLean, who has a particularly interesting view on domestic violence. We'll be having her on the program. We'll be also looking further at the very controversial issue over the New South Wales state government removing the word fathers from the birth certificates and changing 50 different pieces of legislation in Australia. We'll be back next week. And don't forget, you can listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net.